This episode is brought to you in part by supporters like Brianna, Suze, Ronnie, and David M. Thank you so much, guys. For more background on the materials I cover on the podcast, plus case updates, bonus book reviews, and more, head to the Best Evidence newsletter at bestevidence.fyi and become a subscriber. Or give it as a gift. During the 12 days of Best Evidence promotion, which is on right now, you can get a whole year for $52. That's just $1 a week for headlines, capsule reviews, and bonus blotter briefs, debriefs, delivered straight to your inbox each weekday. That's bestevidence.fyi. And now, the episode.
Yes, I've had days where I just had to make myself go in there. I didn't feel up to it. I've had days when I've cut it short.
Let us belatedly give thanks to all the true crime crap that's been cluttering up my DVR, and I'm guessing some of y'all's, for the last couple of months. I mean years. Anyway, it's time to see whether various PBS properties, Oxygen special events, and upcoming Netflix miniseries are worth hanging on to. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 123. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that wades through the true crime media that's up to our waists these days to find the stuff that's not a waste. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and this week I'm talking about a half dozen shows I looked at over the Thanksgiving break. Am I giving each one a continuance or granting myself a motion to dismiss it? Let's get started with that first cold case. We're beginning with Murder and Justice, the case of Martha Moxley. This three-part limited series aired on Oxygen in June of this year and is hosted, although that doesn't seem like quite the right word, by typically self-regarding former federal prosecutor Laura Coates. This is one of those Oxygen properties seemingly designed to be viewed in a waiting room, slow and repetitive enough that people only half paying attention until they're called in to get the drops can follow along. And, you know, Oxygen.
A heartbroken family holds its breath for answers. Then, 25 years later, a new suspect is pulled into the limelight. The heir to a family fortune and a Kennedy cousin.
Michael Skakel.
If you're sitting on your commute, resisting the urge to mutter Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice to yourself, friend, I am right there with you. Obviously. This case is not a candidate for the standard Oxygen treatment, it seems to me, at least as far as juice to squeeze ratio. Its various red herrings, switchbacks, and feuds took literally decades to show themselves, so a show like this that spends a couple of obligatory segments on moist voiceovers about looking at crime through the eyes of a mother is wasting your time in more ways than one. The reenactments border on the tacky. The close-ups of Mrs. Moxley looking at photographs of her child, intercut with Coates making, that's hard, faces, are performative and useless, and Oxygen just isn't nearly as good as Vanity Fair, because nobody is, at capturing the Greenwichness of it all. The tragedy amongst the 1% angle is not irrelevant as far as enduring interest in this case. Nobody ever went broke recapping Kennedy fuckery, God knows, but I'm going to link to Dominic Dunn in the show notes, as well as New York Magazine's account of the bad blood between Dunn and RFK Jr. as a result of Dunn's position on the guilty party. And honestly, if you can find Murder in Greenwich on YouTube, that's a better bet than this. It's a weird little TV movie starring, among others, Chris Maloney and a pointless hairpiece as Mark Furman, but it's entertaining and it gets the job done faster than Murder and Justice. I am granting your motion to dismiss this one. Moving on to the next cold case. Timothy McVeigh in defense of. Here's the case file. Defense attorneys Chris Tritico and Stephen Jones detail their time representing Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh in his capital murder trial and their efforts to spare him the death penalty. Note, I probably massacred the pronunciation of Tritico. Feel free to at me. That's Blotter Presents on Twitter. I know very little about this case, relatively. Although I do remember coming home for lunch that day. At the time, in the year after I graduated university, I was living with my parents and working various freelance gigs, and I would come back to the homestead at noon for a sandwich and some daytime TV. One of the local affiliates had a Jump Street, Hill Street rock block at noontime, but that day it was obviously preempted, and my mom and I sat at the kitchen table and looked at the sheared-off front of that building and were speechless, really, which for both of us at once is pretty rare. I also remember being struck when I heard about In Defense Of by the idea of a show or special centered primarily around the legal team of a notorious defendant. For whatever reason, my DVR kept recording the McVeigh episode only over and over, but this is a four-part series with other episodes about Jodi Arias, Ted Bundy, and Clive Doyle's legal teams. I had not heard of Doyle. He was evidently a Branch Davidian, who also got his own episode of Frontline at some point, so if any of you has seen that one and wants to recommend it or not, let me know. You can watch In Defense Of on Amazon or head to Oxygen's website, which has at least the McVeigh episode. And I think this one is worth watching. It's not as cynically... I don't know how to put this, but sometimes ID and Oxygen seem to start with a niche concept, like Wives with Knives or Sisters of No Mercy or whatever, and work backwards from there. This is a legit fresh perspective. It moves along pretty well. Each episode is only an hour, and I learned things. In this next clip, which is a bit long, McVeigh's attorneys, first Tritico, then Jones, are talking about the death penalty and then the fact that you can't just plead guilty in a capital case.
I don't believe in the death penalty. I haven't my entire career.
Blowing up the Murrah Federal Building and killing 168 people is an atrocious and despicable act. And that crime deserves punishment and justice. But I don't believe that there's a situation that piling another death on top of death really solves anything. Life without parole is just as effective a means of punishment as executing someone and taking their life away. There's a traditional theory about capital cases that if you know you're going to get convicted, you try the case to a life sentence. You spend the entire trial putting on mitigation punishments so that the jury will give a life sentence. The first thing that pops into your mind is insanity defense. Tim would not participate in even looking at an insanity defense.
So then he said, well, I've thought about it and I want to plead guilty. I said, well, that won't work either.
In a capital murder case, a defendant can't plead guilty. The law doesn't allow it. If the government is going to say, we want to extinguish this person's life, it has to be proven to a jury first.
I mean, of course it does, but for whatever reason, it had never occurred to me explicitly put that way before. That moment comes about 12 minutes into that episode, and that's where I decided to give it a continuance. Cold case number 3. I think we are all married to that sousaphone in subcultures by now. Get used to it. Anyway, moving along to Point of View, aka POV, season 32, episode 14, Blowing Up. Here's the case file from the DVR logline. The challenges facing a group of women determined to change the way women arrested for prostitution are prosecuted. End quote. I am a big proponent of decriminalizing sex work for various obvious reasons. Safety is one. Institutional bias in a system that creates an underclass that can only react to the vicious cycles touched off by a single arrest or law enforcement contact is another. So I was looking forward to digging into this installment of POV, but at the same time, POV can be a crapshoot. Some POV offerings are lecturing homework. In a way, other PBS properties like American Experience or Frontline have learned to either mitigate or make part of their brands. I thought Blowing Up might have some issues with preaching, specifically preaching to the choir. And it may yet, but 15 minutes in, I was convinced it's worth sticking around for the hour and a half runtime. It's a little overproduced right up top with some dirgy music and some pointed focus pulls of various courthouse doors and massage parlor signs. But then an interested party gets a talking head spot just after the credits, and we'll hear part of it in clip four.
It's not easy to be, you can't just walk away. There's no just walking away. It's either he wants you to pay him to leave or he just doesn't want you to leave. And you get beat for wanting to leave or whatever. You don't get phone privileges. You get privileges taken away and everything. It's hard. I'm trying to move forward. I do it because I'm financially stuck. I'm financially not together right now. And I'm just trying to get myself together. And if that's what I have to do, then that's what I'm going to end up doing.
Phone privileges, like she's a child. Fuck off, pimps. This sex worker, who started in the business to make her boyfriends bail for him, and don't get me started on that broken quote-unquote system, but anyway, she's very fidgety, all shy smiles and playing with her bangs. It's quite distinctive, the way she is when she's being asked to tell her story as a survivor and an accidental activist of sorts, versus as a perp. The verite scenes that follow in the Queens County Courthouse take a few minutes to get going, but I like that we're dropped right into these cases and situations, and then an atmosphere and a set of stories begin to cohere out of the noisy collage. Director Stephanie Wang Briel, I hope I pronounced that one right. After my battles with Tupac last week, I'ma just apologize in advance always and assume I did biff it, even if your name is, you know, John Jones. Anyway, this director also made a documentary about a custody battle in the foster system called Tough Love, and I'm inclined to hunt that one up too. And here again, if you'd like to weigh in, I'm always happy to hear from you at Blotter Presents on Instagram and Twitter. And once again, that's POV Season 32, Episode 14, Blowing Up. It aired in October of this year. You can watch it on the PBS site and, I assume, the app, and it's receiving a continuance. All right, husband sousaphones. The next cold case is Hunting JonBenet's Killer, The Untold Story. Case file, again from the DVR, quote, Elizabeth Vargas takes a fresh look at the most notorious cold case murder in American history as new leads are tracked and new DNA tests are conducted, featuring an exclusive interview with John Ramsey as well as many never-before-seen photos. The intro montage to Hunting JonBenet's Killer makes much of these photos, and with the greatest sympathy for Mr. Ramsey's many losses over the years, I just don't see what more photos of the child will do to help in this case. It's not as though she's missing but presumed alive. There is also almost nobody who is alive who doesn't know what she did look like in makeup and out. How does this move the ball? And how does all this time watching Vargas's Jeep picturesquely traversing the highways of eastern Utah en route to Ramsey's house move the ball? And then there's clip five.
Hi.
Hi.
John?
Yes.
Elizabeth.
Hi, Elizabeth. Nice to meet
Very
you.
Very nice to meet
Same
you.
Here.
Thanks so much. Should we go inside?
Yeah, thanks to that garbage scene, I'm out. At least it happens not quite 4 minutes into the thing and saves me the rest of the 2 hours, but shit's sake, A&E, the camera crew is in the driveway already. Who the fuck does Vargas think John Ramsey is, Santa Claus? Okay, that choice is in poor taste on my part under the circumstances in terms of famous people, but come on. This is not to pick on Vargas. As hosts of these sweaty specials go, she's fine. And this kind of filler is standard operating procedure and not her fault. Also, her hair looks fantastic. And I doubt I'd have gotten far even without this kind of flagrant B-rolling, because I wouldn't call myself a JonBenet case expert, but I live in the world. And out here in the world, if this much ballyhooed year-long investigation had uncovered anything actionable, we'd have heard about it. And we haven't. There's just the usual trickle of stories about tertiary, at best, case figures, like that fucknuts who photographed JonBenet for her portfolio back in the day, who got arrested last week on child pornography charges in Oregon. I also know that John Ramsey would not have participated in any investigation that wasn't going to stay 100 nautical miles away from his surviving child. And any case overview worth a damn is going to have to concede that while theories involving Burke may not be workable, they exist. I am very sorry for this man and his family, particularly as the Christmas season is rolling around once again, and I hope one day he finds peace with the case or wherever it is that he seeks it. But I don't think this kind of goofy exercise is worth his time or yours, listeners. Motion to dismiss granted. Almost done with that sound drop, I swear to God. Next up in the Cold Case Parade is an independent lens episode called The Force. Here's the case file from the PBS website. Quote, at a powder keg moment in American policing, The Force presents a fly-on-the-wall look deep inside the long-troubled Oakland Police Department as it struggles to confront federal demands for reform, a popular uprising following events in Ferguson, Missouri, and an explosive sex scandal, end quote. I could apply my comments about POV and crapshootery to Independent Lens, but Independent Lens is slightly more reliable, and one can predict a certain level of quality from a Sundance Director's Award winner. The Force had Peter Nix and his team following Oakland PD for 2 years, starting in 2014, and while the result isn't a stunning departure for the format or anything, by the time I even looked up, it was 28 minutes in, so I'm definitely granting this one a continuance. I think what I'm liking best about The Force is how much time it spends with cadets in the police academy. The striking sequence in which they're all getting subjected to tear gas and one cadet finally freaks fully out and barges out of the training compound. And there's also this clip, which uses dashboard cam footage of an officer-involved shooting as discussion group fodder during a class. The footage of the audio may be too distressing for some listeners, so if you need to, it might be a good time to skip ahead a couple of minutes before clip six.
Hands up! Hands up, Ernie! Don't you move! Ernie, don't you move! I will shoot you! Hands up! Now! Go to that door! Shut fire! Shut fire! On the ground now!
All right, you need me to rewind it?
Look how many commands he gives. Look at him.
Wait.
Look at him. He's still trying to do something right now.
He took the time to wait and shoot another one in his back.
You're shot 13, 20 times or whatever. And again, we don't shoot to kill. We shoot to neutralize the threat.
And that's what he did.
If he had a knife and he's on the ground gasping for air, facing away from the officer, isn't that threat neutralized?
That's all that was recovered and that we know of now. At the time...
This is the age-old debate. That's just too many fucking shots, period, versus it's easy to say that if you aren't in the situation. But it's interesting to hear it taking place in class at a police academy. It's also, in my opinion, footage worth enduring lest we get too inured to or abstracted from police-involved shootings involving alleged excessive force. Whatever he may or may not have been in the act of when he was shot more than a dozen times, the man we hear getting fired on belonged to someone. And we also hear that. And police officers, present and future, have to reckon with that as a part of these split-second decisions they're faced with. And we hear that conversation happening. It's somewhat unexpected, in a good way. I'll keep watching. The Force is nearing the 2-year mark on my DVR, because it's like that over here. So while it has fully expired on various PBS online channels, I guess if you wait long enough, shit will probably show up on Netflix, and this has. I will link to this in the show notes, as I will with everything else, and once again, I am granting The Force a continuance. And here we are at the front line. Season 37, Episode 12, Predator on the Reservation. I probably don't need to read you a case file, but I will anyway. Quote, a pediatrician is accused of abusing Native American boys on various reservations for more than a decade. End quote. Well, look, it's a front line. It's not going to be a cheery cavalcade of senior cat adoptions. It's about a specific doctor, Stanley Patrick Weber, who abused boys on reservation after reservation, then moved or was moved elsewhere, Catholic priest style, to continue preying on children. It's also about the more general struggle of the Indian Health Service to find the best, brightest doctors, and the possible perception among med students that, like college infirmaries, a reservation job is for second-raters. And it's about how, while the particulars of setting may vary, we've all got to start trusting our instincts when it comes to seeing grooming behavior that is then normalized by our silence. Clip 7.
He took the kids to Great Falls shopping. He took them to basketball tournaments when our kids would qualify. To us, that was getting the community used to seeing him with these kids and the implication of parental permission.
This is grooming behavior. So you take kids who are high risk, who are from difficult family circumstances, and who are poor. And you offer them new clothes, and you offer them food, and you offer them, you know, a home where the lights are on all the time. A child will gravitate toward that.
Dan Foster says he decided to confront Dr. Weber.
I had these concerns. And I wanted him to know that I was bringing these concerns forward. My hope was that if he were doing something, he would stop. And if he weren't, he would be warned and would modify his behavior accordingly. But he did not.
No, of course he did not. Why would he? This clip is, among other things, one of the more cogent and concise summaries I've heard of how and where monsters who sexually abuse children operate. That kind of summary is frontline strong suit, whether it's the many lapses in our criminal justice system, bioterror, or political corruption that's the topic. And while I had a bad smell frown on my face the whole time, I did watch the whole thing. Once again, that's Frontline's Predator on the Reservation, and it is available on the PBS app. Continuance granted, but if you think that means I'll be able to face the sex trafficking episode of Frontline that's been on the DVR since Memorial Day, let me remind you that I am not better than anyone. All right, Sousaphones, beat it. We're wrapping this up with a Most Wanted. I'm talking about the upcoming The Confession Killer, which will be dropping on Netflix this coming Friday, December 6th. Here is the case file per Netflix's landing page. Quote, Henry Lee Lucas rose to infamy when he confessed to hundreds of unsolved murders. This docuseries examines the truth and horrifying consequences. End quote. The Confession Killer is the latest limited true crime series from Netflix, and whether you give it a continuance may depend on a couple of factors. One is how fatigued you are by serial killer content at this point in your true crime consumption life. Another is how much you might know already about Lucas. It does feel to me as though this guy was a cultural omnipresence 20 to 30 years ago. Maybe that's because in the days when I was involved with a capital F film guy, that Rooker joint was one of those boys revere it, I don't get it, points of contention that everyone in our cohort had seen, even if they didn't have a strong opinion, that now it seems like Lucas is something of a footnote. The way directors Robert Kenner and Taki Oldham reset. Now it seems like Lucas is sort of a footnote. But the way directors Robert Kenner and Taki Oldham frame his story, at least in the first episode of The Five, he's a significant footnote because of the questions he raises about false confessions, about the death penalty, and about the kinds of charismatically notorious murderers whose compulsion seems to be not murder per se entirely, but the dark attention that it brings. Here's a Texas Ranger talking about the fact that to get Lucas to tell them anything of value, they had to basically make it out like they wouldn't let him tell them anything at all. Here's our final clip.
I had to keep him up in cigarettes. He drank coffee 24/7. He just loved talking. Well, I talked to him day and night, and I just couldn't get him to give me anything. I could prove he's lying, but I just couldn't get a confession, and so I finally told the sheriff, I said, look, let's just put him in jail and just not talk to him. Tell your people not to talk to him. I ain't gonna come up here and talk to him like he's used to me doing. And the sheriff said, well, I got some plowing to do anyway. And so we stuck him in jail and didn't talk to him. Wednesday night, I get a call. He's passed a note to the jailer. He told me what he did to Kate.
Without mentioning any other famous figures that we might, perhaps ones in the Oval Office, who function like tumors whose blood supply is media coverage, oh, will you look at that? Guess it's Prideritio Wednesday here at The Blotter Presents. My point is, the series does seem positioned to look at that very concept over the next handful of hours, and I am always up for a meta-examination of the distortions that this genre can enact on itself and on the true stories it's trying to tell. The pacing of The Confession Killer is somewhat deliberate, but not in an unpleasant way. It gives you the texture of turn of the 80s Texas and the sense of what it's like for law enforcement officers to endure these subhumans and their revolting boasting for the sake of trying to close cases. This one is pretty watchable, but you don't have to give it your full attention if you have cards to write or gifts to wrap. Continuance is granted. Thank you so much for joining me on this cold case journey. Sorry about all the tubas, but the good news is my DVR is under 50% for the first time since I moved into this house in April of 2017. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Kevin Smokler on the Detective Trap podcast and Rachel Monroe's Savage Appetites. That last one's a book, so you should get it out of the library now if you haven't already. And the week after that, I'll be talking with a guest, TBD, about Truth Be Told. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and at Eve's and my true crime review newsletter, Best Evidence. bestevidence.fyi. Remember, now through December 15th, you can get a whole year of Best Evidence for yourself or a loved one, or a frenemy, for just $52. If you like the podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you could tell a friend and rate it on your podcast app. Thanks so much for listening to The Blotter Presents. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.